From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We are joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccans. Most importantly, you are you. You are here. And that makes this the stuff they don't want you to know. This is a very special interview, folks. It's one we've been looking forward to for quite a while. If you are hearing today's show on the day it publishes, it is January 17th, the day that the U.S. and the world commemorates the life and work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Based in Georgia, Dr. King's work left a fundamental mark on the fabric of American society and also inspired an ongoing fight for justice across the planet. As you know, his life met a tragic early end on April 4th, 1968, when he was assassinated. The ensuing investigation left Dr. King's supporters, friends, family, and a great deal of the American public skeptical. So now, more than 50 years after his death, people are still working to understand what actually happened. And that's what we're diving into today. But we're not diving in alone. We are joined with the journalist, author, podcaster Bill Klaber, co-creator of the RFK tapes. And also, we're joined to speak with him about his newest project, the MLK tapes, in which Bill applies his investigative acumen to the controversy and the ongoing questions surrounding the assassination of the legendary civil rights leader, Martin Luther King Jr. Bill, thanks so much for joining us on air today.
It's a pleasure to be here, Ben. Thank you.
Now, one of the first questions that comes up in any of our research in preparation for these interviews is the question of inspiration and motivation on your part as the creator of this project. Folks may not be aware that you have also been the co-creator of the RFK Tapes podcast. And one of our first questions is, what inspired you to reinvestigate the story of that assassination? And in what ways did this project inspire you to begin unraveling the story of Dr. King?
Well, we go back a ways if we're going in that direction. And it was 30 years ago that I joined a group of people who were looking into the murder of Robert Kennedy, and specifically looking at the police files that had just been released after 20 years of secrecy. I mean, Robert Kennedy was murdered. They said this guy did it, and yet their police files were off limits to everyone. And they finally were forced open in 1988. And I was with a group of people who started going through them, and we were shocked by what we were finding. And we understood right away why these files were secret, because it was a record of the police misconduct, their fabrication of evidence, destruction of evidence, and coercion of witnesses. And I went in and interviewed Sirhan in prison. It was a difficult thing to do, came out, and I wrote an article on what I had found, or I wasn't the only one, but what we had found in the police files. And it was a terrific article, and no one was interested. They just didn't want it. So I went back to upstate New York, and thought, you know, I've got these tapes of the police threatening these witnesses. And I just got this idea. I went to a little public radio station upstate New York, and we put together this 1-hour documentary called the RFK tapes. And we just put it out there, and it was picked up by 160 public radio stations across the country. I didn't even know there were 160 public radio stations. And it was picked up by that. And then the week after, the Time magazine came out with a full-page review of the documentary, and St. Martin's Press called me up and asked me to write a book. Now, that was all on a story that nobody wanted. And what's the takeaway from that? The takeaway from that is that if you can, there is great power if you can hear the actual witnesses' voices as opposed to someone talking about the case. And that's what we had in the RFK tapes. So a few years ago, when I ran into a man who had spent decades investigating the murder of Martin Luther King and had dozens and dozens of audio tapes, it wasn't a great leap for me to think of doing a podcast. And that's how the MLK tapes got started.
Yeah, let's really dive into that. I want to talk about the tastes themselves. The person that you're referring to there is William Bill Pepper, and he's somebody that you've been speaking with for quite a while now, and he is the person from whom you've got all of these tapes that we're going to be hearing in the show. What was his involvement with Martin Luther King and with James Earl Ray? Just tell us a little bit about that.
That's an incredible story. And Bill Pepper was friends with Martin Luther King during the last year of his life. He had gone to Vietnam. He had sent himself to Vietnam to see what was going on there. And he came back with photographs and stories of what he had seen. And it was shocking what he had seen, because what we were doing over there with napalm and white phosphorus was not what we said we were doing. And he came back and nobody wanted his story. Nobody wanted his photographs. And finally, he shopped around and Ramparts magazine stepped up and took his story and took his photographs. And Martin Luther King saw the article and saw the photographs and called him up and said, I want to see you. I want to talk to you. And the two of them met, and Pepper showed King what he had. And Pepper said that King actually wept when he saw the photographs of the children that were burned, horribly, horribly burned. So they started a relationship, and Pepper was one of the influences why King had come out in the spring of 1967 at Riverside Church and came out against the war in Vietnam. And he and Pepper worked together the next year, and then King was assassinated. And Pepper believed at first the same thing that everybody else did, that James Earl Ray was the guy who killed King, and there wasn't really that much more to it. And it was only a few years later when Ralph Abernathy, King's number two, called Pepper on the phone and said, I don't like what I'm hearing. I'm not believing what I'm hearing. And I'd like to go talk to this guy Ray myself. Would you come with me? And Pepper said, yeah, okay. I don't really know that much about the case. I need to look into it a little. But they agreed to go. And that summer, they went up to Brushy Mountain State Prison, sat down with James Earl Ray, talked to him for 5 hours. And they each came away with the almost certain knowledge in their own minds that Ray had not shot King. So that started Bill's investigation into the murder of his friend. And he started going to Memphis and asking questions and talking to people. And once it became known that there was somebody interested, people started coming out of the woodwork. People started coming forward. This is what I saw. This is what I heard. And gradually the case built up. But, you know, I mean, a lot of things happened between his investigation was 40 years long. But it's amazing how many people stepped forward, especially as they approached death. People all of a sudden had pangs of conscience. People didn't want to die with the information they were holding, and they would come forward. And every time somebody came forward, he would sit them down, put them under oath, and record what they had to say. And that's the material that we have to work with on the MLK tapes.
One of the questions that leads me to naturally, I think it's something a lot of people in the audience today will be wondering, is Bill, before you began working on this project, on this deep dive into the assassination, what would you say was your typical understanding going in? Like, did you accept the official conclusions of the U.S. government, or did you have your own questions that you brought to the story?
I was in law school when Martin Luther King was shot, and I at first thought that, I mean, there was a lot of crap going on in the 1960s, a lot of people getting shot, a lot of people getting killed, and it didn't matter how powerful they were getting killed anyway. And so it wasn't a great leap to think that or something really underhanded happened with King. So that was my first thought. But then this guy, James Earl Ray, was arrested. He eventually pled guilty to the crime. And like a lot of other people, I thought, well, that was that. But the basic story was this guy was so had so much hatred for black people and so much hatred for Martin Luther King that he escaped prison and then went out and searched for King and found him and killed him because he hated him so much. And that was a very bogus story. But I, like a lot of people, believe it, because there really wasn't anything else to believe. But I had suspicions. But I just want to say that, you know, for a lot of people listening to this podcast, Dr. King is an historical figure. He's like Abraham Lincoln. Well, he wasn't like Abraham Lincoln to me. I remember when he came to my college and he spoke, and he stood up and he spoke. There were no notes. He just spoke from the heart, and he talked about how difficult the road was going to be going forward. It wasn't going to be as easy as just getting a seat on the bus. It wasn't going to be as easy as getting a seat on the lunch counter. And he was talking about how he wanted to fight for economic justice, not just civil rights. He was moving away from civil rights, and he hadn't yet come out against the war, but that was just coming just in a few months from them. And I was also in New York City when he spoke just a couple of weeks after he gave the speech at Riverside Church, and he spoke at the steps of the United Nations. And the man who introduced him at that rally, and there was more people than I'd ever seen in one place. It just as far as you could see, there were people. And the man who introduced him was Bill Pepper, introduced him at that rally in New York City. And I don't remember what Pepper said. That didn't register. But I do remember what Martin Luther King said. And you could hear his voice booming out, "Stop the bombing. Stop the bombing. Save our national honor and stop the bombing." So he was a real person to me. He wasn't just some historical somebody. I've had a lot of feelings because I came of age in the 1960s, and there's a lot of anger inside me because of what I saw happen, and looking into the murder of Robert Kennedy, and to a certain extent John Kennedy, has just made me mistrust a lot of things that were said to us back then.
You know, I think it's easy to take for granted, like, how today we have access to so much information, like, literally at our fingertips, the whole of history, of music, of culture. And so it's maybe a little easier to be distrustful and question these kind of narratives that, you know, get put forth. Because, you know, now with the, you know, the benefit of hindsight, the story around James Earl Ray just stinks to high heaven. And just even just common sense kind of makes one feel, with even a little bit of research, that there's just something weird going on there. But why at the time do you think it was easier to swallow that story? Was it something that people just needed to put this to bed because it was so painful? Or was it just kind of like something that made sense, you know, given that lack of, you know, what we have to work with today?
I would say neither. I think what it was, well, first of all, James Earl Ray was arrested in Great Britain. He was brought to the United States. He was then put in a cage for 8 months where the lights were not turned off at all anytime during the day. He was only allowed to see his brother and his lawyer. So he's kept incommunicado the whole time. And when he, you know, when they finally let him come out, it was to make a plea of guilty to the charges. So whenever I have a conversation with someone and I say, oh, I'm working on the Martin Luther King case, the common reaction is, well, the guy said he did it. What's the big deal? And that's what they were going for, because if they could get a plea of guilty out of him, they would never have to explain any of the rest of it. And so what we're trying to do in this podcast is we have a whole episode, I think it's number 4, where we go into how that plea actually came about and how he was forced into it. And it's a nasty, nasty story. But, you know, that's what people will come back at you with. Well, he said he did it. And, you know, the answer is no. He always denied it. He always said he did not kill Martin Luther King from the first moment he said it to his last breath.
But there is no reason to question it. For you, for someone that was even as close and to him as a person, to King, or at least in terms of, like, you know, a person you respected and saw, you know, speak in real life, there was nothing in the back of your mind that made you at the time question it because of those reasons.
I wouldn't say nothing. I questioned a lot of stuff, but you know, there wasn't anything to hang your hat on. There wasn't anything that you could use to know, and. So I was suspicious. I just
because it was buried. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Well, so I want to get into this, the concept of the trial. And, you know, we don't have to go too deep into it, but James Earl Ray was never given a proper trial by a jury because he pled guilty. He attempted to appeal that plea, I think, a few days later, right? Maybe 3 days later.
3 days.
And he was unable to get that to happen. And there's some weird circumstance there, too. I'll let you listen to the podcast to get some of that. But some evidence did come forward in some, let's say, some ways that you may not expect. And this was mind-blowing to me, and I learned it through the creation of this podcast, was that there was a 1993 mock trial of James Earl Ray that aired on HBO. I was 10 years old at the time. I had no idea this occurred. I've never seen footage of it until I was like forced to, because I was, you know, making this show with you. And it blew my mind to know that some evidence was actually put on trial in a mock way, and people got to watch HBO and learn about it. Can you tell us a little bit about that mock trial and what happened?
It was a great idea. It goes to the creativity of Bill Pepper and the energy he brought to this case. And he tried to get Ray a real trial. They appealed the case. He went to the state, and he went to federal court, and he went to a federal appeals court, and he finally went to the Supreme Court, saying this man never got a trial. He was denied the trial he was entitled to, and he failed. He just couldn't get a trial for James Earl Ray. And then the idea came to, he knew this producer in Great Britain who said, why don't we put one on, you know, and HBO signed on for it. And it was a big undertaking. They had a real federal judge, retired federal judge, overseeing the case and using the laws of the state of Tennessee. And they had a real jury that was selected, impartial jury. And they had a U.S. prosecutor from Memphis, Hickman Ewing, on the other side. And they conducted the trial and put on the evidence and introduced the witnesses pretty much just as you would at a trial. James Earl Ray also testified, and he was cross-examined by Hickman Ewing, who gave him a rough time, but he just stuck with his story. But this was as close to a real trial as you could get. And, you know, the jury decided that they didn't meet the requirement of reasonable doubt, and they acquitted him, which, by the way, is what his original attorneys, who we might get to later, thought they were going to do in the first place after they took the case on. They thought the evidence against Ray was really thin, and what there was of it appeared to have been planted. So, I mean, anyway, this trial, this HBO trial, They got their first win, their first big win. Of course, nobody covered it, so you know it wasn't very well known.
And this is one of the things. There are so many questions I want to return to, but let's stay on this for a moment, because this is one of the things that I think much of history conveniently forgot is the narrative that a lot of children in the U.S. are taught in school is inarguably sanitized in some ways, right? Or at least focuses on some things and kind of glosses over others. And if you count the mock trial as at the very least the closest to a trial that Ray got, it may surprise other people to know that the King family successfully won a civil suit in 1999. This suit, I believe, also, at least temporarily, inspired the Department of Justice to reopen their investigation. Could you tell us a little bit about the civil suit, a little bit about how, like, the order of operations in which it broke down, and what that means to the investigation as people perceive it today? I'm looking specifically for the finding where they agreed it was a conspiracy.
The civil trial in 99, gosh, how to exactly explain it? It was a terrific idea, because it was a way to use a civil suit to sue a person who they knew was involved in the murder, and then various unnamed government agencies in the murder of Martin Luther King. And, you know, they were only asking for $100 worth of damages. But what the whole purpose of it was, that they could get in the context of this trial, they could get all the witnesses that were still alive and that could testify, get them up and have them testify under oath in a court of law and have that testimony be part of that trial. And so where it would be accessible to history. And so that was the big takeaway there. And the fact that they won the case, I don't think means a whole lot, because there wasn't a lot of opposition on the other side. They were only looking for $100. To a certain extent, it wasn't as important event as you might think it was in terms of the verdict. But in terms of the process, in terms of all the people who went and testified, in terms of the participation of the King family and what Coretta Scott King said after the trial, that's the importance of it. So sometimes people say, oh, well, there really wasn't anybody fighting on the other side. And that's the truth. And they could have made a bigger mess of things if there had been. But what it was a way to get the evidence out in front. And they did that.
And with that, we're going to take a quick moment to hear a word from our sponsor, but we'll be right back.
And we've returned with Bill Claver.
So I want to talk about the Department of Justice's reaction to that trial and to its conclusion. I'm going to read you a tiny little excerpt here from their website, justice.gov. They say, we recommend no further federal investigation of the Jowers allegations. The man's name is Lloyd Jowers, by the way, who was sued. Or any other allegations related to the assassination unless and until reliable, substantiating facts are presented. At this time, we are aware of no information to warrant any further investigation of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. So they say that in response to everything that came forward during that civil trial, stuff that had occurred before, which, you know, became a part of the civil trial. Why do you, Bill, think there is more to this case than the Justice Department does?
Well, they came to the same conclusion that the FBI came to the day after Martin Luther King was shot. They came to the same conclusion that a House Select Committee on Assassinations came to, even though there were numerous examples of the House Select Committee stumbling on some piece of the truth. And then all of a sudden realize they're in that situation and they make up another cockamamie story instead of saying, oh, I see James Earl Ray actually didn't have a racial motive and wasn't driven by hate. Do they then say, oh, maybe he didn't shoot King? No, they say, well, he probably did it to get a reward for the bounty, of which there is no evidence at all. And several different times they would come upon something like that Percy Forman was a big liar was another one of their conclusions because he went and testified and he just revealed himself as a total crap head. And they said nothing he said can be relied upon. Do they then think, oh, maybe this guy who pushed his way into the case, who's such a liar, maybe he was working for somebody else? No, they don't do that. They just shrug it off. They finally come to the conclusion that James Earl Ray going back and exchanging the rifle he bought for another rifle, they finally realize, oh my goodness, this is 10 years later. That probably means there was somebody else involved. Of course that's what it means, dun, right? Dun. So and they come to that conclusion, but oh my goodness, that can't be, because that's what Ray said, that can't be true. So the next best thing is, you know, it was probably his brother, and that keeps it all in the family. So they keep stumbling over these things that should be clues as to there's something else going on here, and they just make up another phony story. And so the same thing with the Justice Department. Their job was, you know, it gets handed down and handed down, and then they go and they find every little reason to disbelieve every single witness. Oh, this guy lied to his seventh grade teacher about something or other. And so, you know, that was their job. Their job was to find, come out and say, there's nothing to worry about, folks. We've been back in there. We've looked at the evidence. Don't worry. There's nothing to see. That's what they're paid to do.
And this I think, could use a little context for our audience today, because at times concurrent with these investigations or with these shutdowns of investigations, the public was slowly learning about a government program called COINTELPRO. And it wasn't, I believe, confirmed for some time, at least officially, until after King's death, that COINTELPRO, which was a surveillance and monitoring program on the part of Uncle Sam, was actively monitoring and even harassing King and members of his family. Was the DOJ or the FBI, were they motivated to perhaps go with their convenient narrative despite the contradictory facts because of knowledge of COINTELPRO? Or do you believe that played any role in their calculus there?
I don't think that played a role in the calculus so much. I mean, when COINTELPRO came out, everybody was horribly embarrassed. The church committee had hearings, and they were particularly outraged at how this program was used on Dr. King. And so there was a lot of outrage about that. But if you follow it back, it's really hard to understand why Hoover went after King in such a way. Here you had a black leader who had a lot of moral authority and who was standing up and telling people, yes, we want our rights, we want what is due to us, and we want to be nonviolent. We want to obey the law. He was not preaching violence, and yet they were going after him like he was a great danger to the society. And and Hoover was pretending all the time that somehow King was falling under the control of communists, and that was the big reason that he had to have the right to wiretap King. And it's a pretty sad story in the States. Bobby Kennedy briefly gave him the right to wiretap for 1 month, and that was supposed to be, see if you can come up with any, information, communist information, for 1 month. And then John Kennedy was then murdered right after that, and any control that Bobby Kennedy had over Hoover instantly evaporated. And Hoover, within a month, held a big meeting in Washington that Kennedy didn't know about, where all they did is discuss different ways they could bring down Martin Luther King. And that's a matter of record. I listen every once in a while, I'll just to refresh my soul on this thing, I'll listen to a speech that King gave one place or another. And the other day, I just listened to the entire Riverside Church speech on Vietnam. And I would recommend to anybody, if you want to know about Martin Luther King, you want to know about his character, you want to know about his courage, you listen to that speech, because he's standing up. He's the first major public figure to stand up and say, this is wrong. And he knows when he does it. He knows when he does it, it's going to mean the money is going to dry up on his end, and he's going to make big enemies. And he stands up and said, this is wrong to be doing what we're doing there. And you listen to a tape like that and then hear these people bringing forward little stuff to assassinate his character. It makes me sick.
And just to remind everybody, that speech was given exactly 1 year to the day before he was assassinated. Exactly 1 year to the day. And following that speech, that's when he was called a communist by newspapers and, prominent media figures. So just keep that in context.
I mean, I think it's like most of us can tell the difference between rhetoric and political posturing and what Dr. King did. I mean, when you hear him speak, it has a magic to it. There's an absolute, level of charisma that is outside of the charisma of a politician, or someone who is trying to kind of twist the screw and make people behave as they want to. This is a man that put himself in harm's way, that put himself, his reputation, out there in a way where people could besmirch him at every turn, and he didn't care. And so when you hear him make these speeches, they are absolutely the real deal. I mean, whatever you may think, I think that comes through. And I think it's interesting when we're getting towards kind of the intent, like why assassinate Martin Luther King? Yes, he represented a movement, of course, and he was the fifth face of this movement. But the problems that led to the movement being necessary pre-exist, the movement, and you can't really get rid of that problem or the people's discontentment by killing a man. If anything, it's going to make them angrier. And I heard someone in commenting on this tragic event of his passing that they didn't realize that he was the white man's biggest advocate in terms of, keeping these riots from destroying, society and from being out there and preaching nonviolence and things like that. Can you kind of speak to that side of Dr. King and how maybe the people that were trying to assassinate his character, let alone him physically, maybe missed the point, missed that whole idea that he really was kind of there to help them?
It's a little hard to understand. Hoover is a big part of this equation. He's not the only piece, but Hoover had some sort of hatred towards King that is a little bit unexplainable. I think he was a little jealous. I think he was jealous of King and didn't like the attention he was getting. And he liked being the guy that was pushing all the pieces around. And he was used to getting his way because he had secret files on everybody. And he had a lot of files on John F. Kennedy. And one of the reasons that Bobby Kennedy ended up agreeing to the limited wiretapping thing that Hoover so badly wanted was that Hoover had just gotten Kennedy out of another one of his sexual escapades, scrapes with Ellen Ramesh, who was thought to maybe be connected to East German intelligence. And after Hoover rescued Kennedy in his presidency, that might have gone down because they were going to have congressional hearings on this thing. And Hoover then met with the heads of Congress and the Senate and saying, oh, this is going to, you know, blow up in everybody's face and we can't do this and la da da. And he got Kennedy out of it. And then he went back to Bobby and said, well, you know, do I get my wiretaps? And at that point, you know, Bobby said, yeah, okay, you know, for a month or whatever, if you really think you can dig up stuff. And they've often said, oh, Bobby Kennedy was the one who decided to wiretap King. It's not true. He consented because basically their hand was forced and they owed it to Hoover, who not only got him out of that trouble, but got him out of other sexual trouble that he'd gotten himself into.
A quid pro quo, it appears. This might surprise many people to learn that those kind of deals, unofficial but impactful, can occur, and they often occur outside of the public sphere. They're things that the public will learn about in retrospect. And when we're talking about murkiness, Bill, one thing that really stands out to me in episode 3 specifically, we were fortunate enough to get a sneak peek, is just the sheer profundity of murkiness that is involved in this story of James Earl Ray. And I think this gave a lot of red meat to people who were initially claiming there was a cover-up or corruption involved. And I'd love to hear you talk about some things that really stood out to me in your conversations in episode 3, wherein we already talked about how Ray never actually went to a jury trial. He very early on recanted his guilty plea, but he also managed to escape from incarceration, never spoke about who may have assisted him. And despite the fact that he was known to be a petty criminal, our understanding is that he was also found with some pretty good fake identification at one point. Also, you know, let's just throw this out here and emphasize this again. The guy was arrested in Great Britain. How does a petty criminal, who actually doesn't sound like they're that great at petty crime, how does a petty criminal manage to achieve all of these things, to escape from incarceration, to have actionable, like, I'll say it, maybe pro-level fake IDs, and then how does he get across the pond? Are there any answers to these questions?
Well, you know, we're going to be called conspiracy theorists anyway. So, and I don't think of myself as a conspiracy theorist. I'm not a conspiracy guy. I'm an evidence guy. But there are some places where you need to just sort of apply theory to it. And I think his escape from prison is one of them. There is evidence. Ronnie Lee Atkins claims that he and his father drove out to Missouri with $25,000 and gave it to the prison warden in exchange for the release of James Earl Ray. And the idea was that they were looking for some, you know, and they may have had other ideas of other people they wanted to use, but they were looking for someone they could use to be a fall guy, and they thought this guy Ray was perfect for them. And so they allowed him to escape, arranged for him to escape in this bread truck. And then they just kept tabs on him as he traveled around in Canada and other places, and then kind of directed him here or there. You know, it may be that at one point he was sent down to Birmingham and then nothing happened. There might have been some plot to kill King in Birmingham. He was out in Los Angeles for a long time. They say he stalked King. He didn't stalk King. He was out in Los Angeles. King came to Los Angeles. But the thing with Ray is that he would never rat on anybody who helped him. So whether it was whoever helped him escape from prison, this was his culture. He had spent almost his entire adult life in prison. And one of the things he learned is if you just don't rat out anybody. And he wouldn't. Yes, he had fake identities of people that he could never have gotten on his own. He had to have had help. He had to have help escaping from prison. He could not have made that escape on his own. He had to have help and probably permission. You know, there are places where he just will not tell, even to Bill Pepper, various things. He met with people in New Orleans. He says he met with Raul in New Orleans. It might have been more people than that. Maybe Carlos Marcello was in the room. But what good does it do him to say that? Because that'll only assure he gets killed in prison. So it may be that it's a more complicated story than he's been willing to let on. But he knows that, you know, if he starts saying, well, there were these mob guys in New Orleans that I met, it will be the end for him. So I don't know. That's just an idea I have in my head. But he's a strange character, and I don't believe he shot Martin Luther King. I don't believe he knew Martin Luther King was going to be shot. I don't think that everything he told Bill Pepper is necessarily the truth.
Yes, and you've had similar conversations in the course of the MLK tapes. And in some of these conversations, you mentioned something that I want to go back to. It's a character that may not be familiar to people with a cursory knowledge of the assassination and ensuing investigations, a guy named Raul, who apparently appears and as kind of a cameo, and then somehow vanishes from history. So can you introduce our audience to Raul, or at least the story of this person?
Sure. Raul was the person that Ray said he met in Canada and who he started to go to work for, smuggling, doing small smuggling jobs across the border, and then going south, and Raul gave him enough money to buy a Mustang, and then they did some small smuggling jobs in Mexico. And Raul was the one who, according to Ray, who told him to go buy a rifle in Birmingham, and then when he came back with the rifle, said it was the wrong rifle, and he had to go back and exchange it for another gun. So Raul is that character. When Ray tells his story, when he's arrested, he tells his story to Bradford Huey and where he went in Canada and who he met and where he worked and all these things. And Huey was able to substantiate almost all of it. Where he worked at the Indian Trail restaurant, and Huey goes up and talks to those people and said, he was really a gentleman. He was the sweetest guy. He did his work. We saw no evidence of this burning hatred inside this man. But the one person, the only person they can't locate is Raul. But that's not surprising because they didn't know his last name. They didn't know where he lived. They didn't know if Raul was even his correct first name. And Raul certainly didn't want to be located. So it's a little difficult to find this Raul, except we think we may have in the podcast. And stick with us because, you know, there's a certain point where a woman shows up and said, I knew a Raul back in the day, and he kind of acted like he had done something with Martin Luther King. So that's one whole episode we have, and it's a crazy story.
Yeah, there's connections that you wouldn't expect. Like I just, so you know, and so you guys know, I thought Raul was made up. I was like convinced that Raul was made up until I heard some of the stuff that we're going to hear in this episode.
Spoilers, man.
But I mean, but James Earl Ray was a notoriously like bad liar and not particularly bright, right? I mean, I'm not to character assassinate this guy, but like, I mean, it's pretty clear. Like, he didn't really know much about guns. He went in and kind of like bought whatever gun the gun owner, gun store guy told him to, and then came back and returned it. And that was suspicious, all at the behest of this guy, Raul. But then, you know, your Raul kind of ends up being an inconvenient lead if you can't really trace him down, it's easier to wrap it all up in Ray, who's like your bird in the hand, rather than like go chase this mythical, you know, bird in the bush. But I still don't understand the intent. If Raul represented some sort of shadowy group that was trying to assassinate MLK, is it some kind of anarchist bent, like this, like to cause a race war, or like what, in your opinion, based on everything that you know, would the intent be behind such an assassination?
I think there was a mistrust and a hatred towards King that was shared by a number of powerful groups, including the National Police Force under J. Edgar Hoover, including organized crime under Carlos Marcello, and police organizations, particularly, were not fond of this guy who was shaking, especially in the South, where the garbage men were on strike, and King was the guy that was doing all this rabble rousing. There was a very large collection of people who felt a burning hatred towards King. And not only that, and I think this is the clincher, is that there was a great deal of money being made in the war in Vietnam. And there were a lot of people invested in that. And then King was the one who was coming out and saying this was wrong. And it was starting to work its way down into the troops. And their black troops were starting not to obey their officers. There were cases of fragging. And there were people who very much to their inner soul believed that Martin Luther King was a traitor to this nation. They believed that. And when you believe that someone is a traitor to the nation and you have the power to kill them, you just might do it. And I think that's where all this leads.
The greater good argument, right? Tale as old as time, unfortunately. There is just a housekeeping note for anyone unfamiliar with the term. Fragging, could you tell us just a little bit about what fragging was during the Vietnam War?
It was a way that common soldiers could get back at officers who they didn't like or who had done things to them in one way or another. And you're in a firefight somewhere, and your officer is up there, and you've got a gun, and you're shooting a gun, and you just happen to shoot the officer you don't like. And there were, I don't know how many documented cases of that there were, but it was enough. I mean, it did happen. So there were, when the racial thing got introduced, and when Martin Luther King was saying, "What are you doing there?" And all of a sudden, these young black men sort of woke up and realizing, I'm fighting the white man's war. Why am I here? Why am I fighting for the rights of Vietnamese when I don't even have rights back in Georgia, when I don't have rights in Chicago, And so there was that whole line. And I personally think that that was probably the strongest reason behind the murder of King. But it involved a lot of different people who were happy to look the other way. Whoever pulled it off knew that they could do so without any trouble from the FBI. It's a group effort.
Yeah, group effort. Just so, even if the FBI or factions thereof were not directly involved, the picture that is painted, and an accurate picture, I would argue, is one of a large number or a small number of large, powerful interests who wouldn't be heartbroken if this threat to the status quo was to be taken off the board. Would you agree with that estimation? If not conspiracy of multiple players, would you agree that there were many institutions in the mix who were just happy to have him gone?
Well, yes. I think that's true. And the same could be said for John Kennedy, and the same could be said for Bobby Kennedy, that there were enough people that were happy to have them gone that they could put a phony Warren Commission together and, to cover up what, I mean, the evidence of conspiracy in the John Kennedy, and I know we're going a little off, topic here, but the evidence of conspiracy there is like, you go into an apartment that's been burglarized, and you walk in and, there's underwear all over the room. The whole place is a mess. You know that you've been burglarized. Well, that's what the murder of John Kennedy was like. The evidence of it is all over the place. It got a little neater when it came to Martin Luther King and Bobby. But yes, there were a lot of people who could be relied upon not to make trouble. They weren't necessarily involved, but you knew that they weren't going to make up trouble for you. That meant a lot of different things could happen, and a lot of different things did happen.
Okay, we're going to take a quick pause to hear a word from our sponsor, and then we'll be back with more from Bill.
And we've returned. Bill, I want to just talk a little bit about some of the people you created new interviews with for this show. So this isn't, you know, just archival tapes that are being presented. You spoke to people who were there. You spoke to people who are still living, who have stories to tell. And in episode 2, you speak with Reverend James Lawson. And I just want to hear in your words, what are some of the strange things that occurred right before Martin Luther King was assassinated?
I talked to Reverend Lawson. He is one of the giants in the civil rights movement. He would, you know, John Lewis, we lost this year. Reverend Lawson was the mentor for John Lewis, and he organized the lunch counter sit-ins in Nashville, and he was one of the founders of SNCC. He was a good friend of Martin Luther King. And he was the one who brought King to Memphis to help with the sanitation strike. And he was there. And when after King was killed, he went around the city trying to calm the black populations because he just didn't want to see more riots. And also, he got 3 days after King was killed, he got a package in the mail that had a bullet taped to a card that said, "We have one of these for you too, N-word preacher." I assume that James Earl Ray, on his flight to Canada or something, didn't have time to send a bullet to James Lawson. But when I talked to Lawson, he spoke of a number of things that really bothered him that he noticed either before the murder or after the murder. And one of them was that there were two firemen in the firehouse across the street from the Lorraine Motel. Those two firemen were told the day before the murder to report to different fire stations. So they were gone. There was Ed Reddit, who was a police detective who was surveilling King at the Lorraine. It wasn't a nice job. It wasn't that he was protecting King. He was just keeping a list of who was coming and going. And it was his job because he was black and he knew who those people were. So that's why he was doing it. 2 hours before the murder, he is told ordered to go home on a trumped up charge. The thing I think Lawson was most angry about was that when King came to the city and other times, he had an all black police security unit assigned to him, an 8 or 9 man unit who guarded him day and night. And for some reason, on his last visit, that unit was not called to form. And we have Captain Jerry Williams on tape telling us that, you know, that last time he came in, I don't know why, but we weren't told to form. And so King was stripped of his black security guard. There was briefly a 4-man white, all-white security guard sent to the Lorraine, but they went home at 5 o'clock, weren't replaced, and they didn't come back the next day, which was the day King was killed. Now, all that stuff doesn't prove that you know, King was killed by a conspiracy, but it don't look good. And if it was table setting for a murder, then the finger of guilt has to point back to the people with the power to make those things happen. I mean, it's just as simple as that. So, and there were a bunch of things. There was Carthel Whedon, who was the head of the firehouse, who testified later on that day, a pair of guys with fancy IDs, flashing army IDs, asked to have access to the roof of the firehouse. And Whedon brought them up to the roof of the firehouse and let them go there. And he was pretty sure they didn't have rifles, but what they did have with them was photographic equipment. And they were there photographing the Lorraine Motel and the environs around there on what just happened to be the day that Martin Luther King was shot, you know? And Bill Pepper's theory is that they were photographing that. So and looking at the photographs, if they saw anybody who saw something that they didn't want seen, they would know, you know, who it was. And they would have a record. So, but anyway, those people have never come forward. They never came forward and say, oh yeah, we were the photographers that day, which, you know, is highly suspicious. So there was a lot of stuff. And it certainly couldn't be James Earl Ray arranging these things, because he just drifts into town in the middle of the afternoon. And somehow at 6 o'clock, he's able to pull off this elaborate murder.
These are just exercises in scratching the surface of the problems with the official story. And there is exclusivity in the MLK tapes. We're learning in this journey that you're taking us on, Bill, we're learning not just the existing discrepancies that people have been aware of, in some cases for decades, but we're learning new information along the way. And this is something, you know, Matt, you said just as much when you said, you know, I thought Raul was made up. And candidly, for a long time, I thought the same, because there is a, you know, we don't want to spoil too much, but there are moments where it seems that because James Earl Ray is an unreliable narrator at times, a lot of what he says has to necessarily be scrutinized. And with this idea of scrutiny, I have one big question that I'd love to hear the answer for in your own words, Bill. What does the MLK tapes, what does this investigation and the events that it covers, what do they teach us in the modern day? What are lessons people can take away from this assassination that, you know, honestly, many, many people in the U.S. consider unsolved today?
Well, you know, there's a song in Porgy and Bess by Gershwin. It's, it ain't necessarily so. And the things that you're liable to read in the Bible, it ain't necessarily so. And I would say that's the takeaway, that it's important to look behind, to pay attention to the details when things happen. And, you know, if you're going to be fooled by the things that they just sort of throw out there for you, you know, you're going to be fooled a lot of times. So, you know, just be on guard. And, you know, especially with the internet these days, there's a lot of stuff out there that isn't true. And it's, you know, it can be hard to, you know, pick through it and know what's real and what isn't.
I was going to ask, if you do you have any advice on that realm? Because that's really what we try and do on this show, is sift through the stuff, you know, the actual small truths that exist within the noise. But you've been doing this for a long time, Bill. Is there any trick to it?
No, there's no trick to it. There's, in fact, I'm not very good at it, because this whole internet thing is, you know, brand new to me. When I was growing up, and you want to make a telephone call, you didn't dial, you didn't punch any numbers. You just told the operator the number you wanted to call.
But I think what Matt's asking too is, like, beyond the technology, I mean, it's about sort of like a frame of mind, like when you're approaching these types of stories. Like, is there anything that you have learned over the years as to how to kind of clear your mind so that you cannot be influenced by all the noise? Or is it just something that kind of you learn just through experience?
There's a role for common sense to play. And you guys were relating to it before. You're just saying, geez, this guy, Ray, you know, he's a bungler and all this stuff. And somehow, and that was, I was, you know, I mentioned before that I listened to King's speech of at the Riverside Church on Vietnam, and it was so powerful and so intelligent, so with such moral authority. And then I thought, and this bumbler James Earl Ray was the one who killed him? You know, those things just didn't go together. It's like, no, he was killed for an important reason, and the important reason was the power of his words. And it wasn't because some guy that grew up in southern Indiana just hated black people so much that he had to kill King. So I guess the answer to that, your question, is some amount of common sense goes a long way.
Wouldn't you say, though, there oftentimes isn't a profound reason that important people are killed? I mean, like, look at John Lennon. He was killed by a crazed fan, you know, I mean, or sometimes people just get killed by crazy people, you know. I mean, I understand in this situation, I do not think that's what's happening, but how do you kind of reconcile those things and not be influenced, you know, or not be overly looking for profoundness where maybe none exists in other types of cases, maybe?
Well, I'm not so sure that John Lennon wasn't murdered by someone other than just a crazy guy. And the same thing with Allard Lowenstein, who was a congressman in New York and who was looking into the Bobby Kennedy murder. And some guy shows up and shoots him. And, you know, I worked enough in the Sirhan case that there were people at that time, there were federal programs where they were looking how to create robot assassins. It's known. It did happen. MK Ultra. And so, you know, if you can, you know, work on people and mess around with their mind enough to, okay, you know, you're going to go shoot John Lennon. And John Lennon was not a popular guy for the official people. They were trying to get rid of him for years. I don't know what happened there. I have no special knowledge of that. But when something happens like that, I don't automatically think, oh, it's just some crazy guy, because we have too many murders by just some crazy guy. And from what I know, you know, a bunch of them, they're phony official stories.
Yeah, and we've already thrown out a couple of things that are going to send people down a rabbit hole today. Dennis Sweeney, who was the trigger man, right?
Yeah.
Lowenstein. Sirhan, as we've mentioned earlier, is also technically up for parole as we record today. History continues, even after the headlines have left the newspapers and the evening news. And that's one of the things that is crucial to remember. And Bill, again, we want to thank you so much, not just for your time with us and Stuff They Want You to Know today, but perhaps more importantly, for the time and the energy that you have put in to the MLK tapes. Peek behind the curtains, folks. Matt is an EP on this project. Noel and I do not have secret access. We got a little bit of a sneak peek, but we are on the journey with you. And so as colleagues and listeners and fans of the show, Bill, we're hoping maybe you could just give us a quick laundry list of some of the other characters that people will meet in the course of the MLK tapes.
Oh, golly gee. you know, one of my favorites is just coming up, and that's Art Haynes Jr., who was James L. Ray's first attorney along with his father. A smart guy, a really, really, really smart guy. He went to Princeton, graduated from law school, and he's out of law school for 2 months, and all of a sudden he is representing the man accused of killing Martin Luther King. I mean, his head must have been spinning. But he just gave us a really great interview in Birmingham, and he's still practicing law to this day. And he's a man of great conscience, and he was a judge in Alabama for 20 years, and he was appointed by George Wallace. He is not a flaming liberal by any means, and not at all, but he loves the law and he loves the truth. He respects the truth, and he's not afraid to speak out about what he saw as James Earl Ray's attorney and what he discovered. And he's got a great sense of humor, and he tells a really good story. So there's a bunch of funny stories that he tells that I love. Anyway, he's one of the people that is coming up. We got Judge Joe Brown, who had his own TV show for 15 or 16 years. But before he was a TV judge, he was a real judge in Tennessee. And Pepper's attempt to reopen the James Earl Ray case landed in his courtroom. And it bounced around there for a year and a half or 2 years. It was a very messy thing. But Joe Brown is a ballistics expert, a gun lover. And he had a chance to look at the case and examine the gun and the evidence around the gun, the ballistics and the bullets. And he is utterly convinced that the throwdown weapon, the weapon that had raised fingerprints on it, was not the murder weapon. And he's a funny guy. I mean, he's got a great sense of humor also, and tells wonderful stories about what it was like to be black in the legal system in the early days in Memphis. So there's Joe Brown. Gosh, it goes on. There's Glenda Grabo that comes along and tells an incredible story about Raul. And the thing about that story that I love the most is that she also ended up working for Percy Forman, Ray's so-called attorney, who also apparently knew Raoul. I mean, that's bizarre as can be. And
I think that's enough, Bill. We don't want to give too much away. But that's, right. Yes, that's, mm-hmm, that's okay. Coming.
And with that, we are drawing today's interview to a close. The MLK tapes are available as you listen to today's episode wherever you find your favorite shows. And for more information, please do check out the MLKtapes.com. Once again, thank you so much for your time, Bill Klaber. We cannot wait to see how this story unfolds. And we, along with the rest of the audience, except maybe Matt, right, Noel, are listening along with you.
Oh, I'm listening too. Don't worry.
Matt's always listening.
Thanks, guys. It's been a real pleasure being here. I've had fun.
What do you think, fellow conspiracy realists? Do you, like a dwindling number of people in the U.S. today, believe the official narrative behind the MLK assassination? Or do you think there are more questions? We'd love to hear your thoughts. We try to be easy to find online.
Catch us on the internet. We are available in the usual places of note: Facebook, Twitter, YouTube. We exist there under the handle @conspiracystuffshow. If you'd like to find us on Instagram, you can find us @conspiracystuff. If you'd like to find us on Instagram, you can find us @conspiracystuffshow. Or give us a telephone call.
That's right. Use your phone for its intended purpose. Call 1-833-STDWYTK. You can give yourself a cool nickname. Leave a message. We've started saving your nicknames in our system, by the way. So every time more broccoli calls, we know. add your name to the list. That's what I'm saying. You've got 3 minutes. Say whatever you wish. If 3 minutes is not enough time, instead, consider sending us a good old-fashioned email. We are
conspiracy@iheartradio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.